Chapter 3. Maps of the Psyche in Depth Psychology. Toward an Integration of Approaches. Part 1.
It is important to have a good map when we travel to new territories, and inner journeys to non-ordinary realities are no exception. Unfortunately, the cartography of the psyche currently used by Western mainstream psychiatrists and psychologists is painfully superficial and inadequate. It is useless as a guide for deep self-exploration and actually causes serious problems for psychonauts because it considers perinatal and transpersonal experiences, which have great therapeutic and spiritual value, to be products of a pathological process. During the mass self-experimentation of the 1960s, young psychonauts embarking on their inner journeys lacked a roadmap for their ventures into mysterious, non-ordinary realities. They were thus like the early explorers traveling into unknown regions of our planet and discovering new worlds. The early travelers' maps charted the areas they had already visited and contained vast areas marked with the inscription, "Hic sunt leones," "Here are lions." The symbol of the lion, a wild and dangerous animal, was used as a reference to all the unexpected hardships and challenges that could be encountered in the as-yet unexplored territories. Savages, predatory animals, and poisonous plants and snakes. Conversely, there could also be pleasant surprises ahead, friendly and supportive inhabitants, useful fauna and flora, and natural sceneries of stunning beauty. In this chapter, we will explore the history of depth psychology and review attempts to create a map of the human psyche. The world of psychotherapy consists of many competing schools that have serious disagreements about fundamental issues related to this task. These include the answers to what are the dimensions of the psyche? What are its principal motivational forces? Why do symptoms develop? And what do they mean? Which aspects of the client's life experience play the key role in causing emotional and psychosomatic disorders? And what techniques should be used to work with the clients? This is true not only for schools coming from very different a priori philosophical positions, such as behaviorism and psychoanalysis, but also for those that originally started from the same source, such as the approaches created by the psychoanalytic renegades. Even deeper discrepancies can be found between the understanding of the psyche in the Western schools of psychology and psychotherapy and the great spiritual philosophies of the East, such as Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, or Sufism. The work with holotropic states of consciousness has made it possible to bring clarity and simplification into the hopeless labyrinth of Western schools of psychotherapy, and to create a comprehensive map of the psyche as described in an earlier chapter, which also provides a bridge to the spiritual traditions of the East. In this module, we will follow the development of the maps of the human psyche from a historical perspective. We will show which ideas from the founders of these schools withstood the test of time and have been supported by the findings of holotropic research, and which need to be modified or replaced. Sigmund Freud. We will begin the story of the search for the map of the human psyche with the father of depth psychology, Austrian neurologist Sigmund Freud. Holotropic states played a crucial role in the early history of psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. In psychiatric handbooks, the roots of depth psychology are usually traced back to hypnotic sessions with hysterical patients conducted by Jean-Martin Charcot at the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris, and the research in hypnosis, which was carried out by Hippolyta Bernheim and Ambroise Liébault at the Nancy School. Sigmund Freud visited both places during his journey to France and learned the technique of inducing hypnosis. After returning from Paris, he used it in the work with his clients. Freud's early ideas were inspired by his work with a patient whom he treated jointly with his friend Joseph Breuer, who had invited him as a neurological consultant for the case. The young woman, Bertha Pappenheim, whom Freud called Miss Anna O in his writings, suffered from severe hysterical symptoms. During her therapeutic sessions, she was able to enter into an auto-hypnotic trance, during which she experienced spontaneous, holotropic states of consciousness. She regressed to childhood and relived various traumatic memories underlying her neurotic disorder. This was accompanied by abreaction, the expression of pent-up emotions and blocked physical energies. She found these experiences very helpful and referred to them as chimney sweeping. The therapy with Anna O ran into serious problems, though. She developed a strong transference on Breuer and repeatedly tried to embrace and kiss him. She started having symptoms of hysterical pregnancy, pseudocyesis, and claimed that Breuer was the father of her child. This led to a crisis in Breuer's marriage, and the treatment had to be terminated. In their joint work, Studies in Hysteria, Freud and Breuer linked the origin of hysteria to psychotraumatic situations in childhood, primarily incest, during which the child could not adequately respond emotionally and physically. This resulted in a jammed effect, abgeklemmte effect, that then became the source of energy for the symptoms. As therapy for hysteria, Freud and Breuer recommended hypnotic regression, reliving the underlying childhood traumas and emotional and physical abreaction. Freud and Breuer then went their separate ways due to differences about theoretical and practical issues. Breuer pursued physiological hypotheses and continued to use the hypnotic technique, while Freud abandoned the use of hypnosis and became interested in psychological mechanisms. As Freud's ideas matured, he developed a novel set of theories and techniques that he called psychoanalysis. Freud felt increasingly uncomfortable having close contact with his patients and moved from the direct emotional experience in a holotropic state and making the unconscious conscious to the use of free associations in the everyday state of consciousness. Freud got the inspiration for this method from Artemidorus of Daldianus, the ancient Greek who used it for the interpretation of his clients' dreams. However, while Artemidorus used his own free associations, Freud concluded that it made more sense to work with the associations of his patients. He also shifted his emphasis from the conscious reliving of unconscious psychotraumas and emotional abreaction to working with transference neurosis and transference analysis, and from actual traumas to Oedipal fantasies. In retrospect, these were unfortunate developments that sent psychoanalysis and Western psychotherapy in the wrong direction for the next 50 years. Using the method of free associations, Freud conducted groundbreaking research into the human psyche and laid the foundations of a new discipline, depth psychology. Many of his ideas are valuable for psychonauts. He discovered the existence of the unconscious and described its dynamics, developed the technique of dream interpretation, explored the psychological mechanisms involved in the genesis of psychoneuroses and psychosomatic disorders, brought attention to infantile sexuality, and depicted the phenomena of transference and countertransference. He created the first model and cartography of the human psyche, although it was limited to postnatal biography and the individual unconscious. Since Freud single-handedly explored the territories of the psyche, previously unknown to Western scientists, it is understandable that his concepts kept changing as he confronted new problems. However, one element that remained constant during all these changes was Freud's deep need to establish psychology as a scientific discipline. He was profoundly influenced by his teacher, Ernst Brücke, founder of the scientific organization known as the Helmholtz School of Medicine. According to Brücke's view, all biological organisms are complex systems of atoms governed by strict laws, particularly the principle of the conservation of energy. The explicit goal and ideal of the Helmholtz School was to introduce the principles of Newton's scientific thinking into other disciplines to make them truly scientific. It was in the spirit of the Helmholtz School that Freud modeled his description of psychological processes after Newton's mechanics. The four basic principles of the psychoanalytic approach, dynamic, economic, topographical, and deterministic, exactly parallel the basic concepts of Newtonian physics. So, for example, the id, ego, and superego had the properties of Newtonian objects. They were clashing, displacing each other, and where one of them was, the others could not be. Libido energy was flowing through the organism in what resembled a hydraulic system, frequently jamming and causing congestion. Freud's most important specific contributions can be divided into three thematic categories: the theory of instincts, the model of the psyche, and the principles and techniques of psychoanalytic therapy. Freud believed that the psychological history of the individual begins after birth and referred to the newborn as a tabula rasa, a blank or erased tablet. He ascribed a critical role in mental dynamics to instinctual drives, which he saw as forces bridging the psychic and somatic spheres. In his early work, Freud saw the human psyche as a battlefield with two rivaling forces, libido and the non-sexual ego instinct related to self-preservation. He believed that mental conflicts resulting from the clash between these instincts were responsible for psychoneuroses and a variety of other psychological phenomena. Of the two instincts, libido attracted much more of Freud's attention and received preferential treatment. Freud discovered that the origins of sexuality are not in puberty, but lie in early childhood. Drawing on his clinical observations, he formulated a developmental theory of sex. According to him, the psychosexual activities start during nursing, when the mouth of the infant functions as an erogenous zone, oral phase. During the period of toilet training, the emphasis shifts, first to sensations associated with defecation, anal phase, and later with urination, urethral phase. Finally, around the age of 4, these pregenital partial drives become integrated under the domination of genital interest involving the penis or clitoris, phallic phase. This also coincides with the development of the Oedipus or Electra complex, a predominantly positive attitude toward the parent of the opposite sex, and an aggressive stance toward the one of the same sex. At this time, Freud attributed an important role to the overvaluation of the penis and the castration complex. The boy gives up his Oedipal tendencies because of castration fears. The girl moves from her primary attachment to her mother toward the father because she is disappointed by the castrated mother and hopes to receive a penis or child from her father. Overindulgence in erotic activities, or conversely, frustrations, conflicts, and traumas interfering with them, can cause fixation on different stages of libidinal development. Fixation and failure to resolve the Oedipal situation may result in psychoneuroses, sexual perversions, and other forms of psychopathology. Freud and his followers developed a detailed dynamic taxonomy linking different emotional and psychosomatic disorders to specific vicissitudes of libidinal development and the maturation of the ego. Freud also traced difficulties in interpersonal relationships to factors interfering with the evolution from the stage of primary narcissism of the infant, characterized by self-love, toward differentiated object relations, where the libido is invested in other people. During the early stages of his psychoanalytic explorations and speculations, Freud put great emphasis on the pleasure principle, or an inborn tendency to seek pleasure and avoid pain, as the main regulatory principle governing the psyche. He related pain and distress to an excess of neuronal stimuli, and pleasure to the discharge of tension and reduction of excitation. The counterpart of the pleasure principle was the reality principle, or ego instinct, a learned function reflecting the demands of the external world and requiring the postponement of immediate pleasure, frustration by delay. In his later investigations, Freud found it increasingly difficult to reconcile clinical facts with the exclusive role of the pleasure principle in psychological processes. He noticed that in many instances, aggressive impulses were not serving the purpose of self-preservation, and therefore should not be attributed to the ego instinct. This was quite obvious in the inexplicable need to suffer in masochistic individuals, in the self-destructive tendencies of depressed patients, including suicide, in automutilations occurring in certain emotional disorders, and in the repetition compulsion involving self-damaging behavior. Freud used the term beyond the pleasure principle for these phenomena. Consequently, Freud decided to treat aggression as a separate instinct, the source of which was in the skeletal muscles, and its aim was destruction. This gave the final touch to an essentially negative image of human nature depicted by psychoanalysis. According to this view, the psyche is not only driven by base instincts, but it contains destructiveness as its intrinsic and essential component. In Freud's earlier writings, aggression was seen as a reaction to frustration and to the thwarting of libidinal impulses. In his late speculations, Freud postulated the existence of two basic instincts: the sexual instinct, eros, which serves the goal of preserving life, and the death instinct, thanatos, which counteracts it and tends to destroy the organism and return it to an inorganic condition. Freud's final formulations concerning the role of the death instinct appeared in his last major work, An Outline of Psychoanalysis. There, the basic dichotomy between two powerful forces, the sexual instinct, eros, or libido, and the death instinct, Thanatos, or Destrudo, became the cornerstone of his understanding of mental processes and disorders. In The Newborn, Eros plays the predominant role, and the role of Thanatos is negligible. In the course of life, the power of Thanatos increases, and at the end of life, it destroys the organism and reduces it to the inorganic status. The concept of Thanatos helped Freud come to terms with the problem of sadism. He saw it as an attempt to direct Thanatos to another object rather than being its victim. However, he never found a good answer to the problem of sadomasochism, with its close connection between sex and aggression, and the link between the need to both inflict and experience pain. The image of the psyche as a battlefield with Eros and Thanatos as two rival forces was a concept that dominated Freud's thinking in the last years of his life. This major revision of psychoanalytic theory generated little enthusiasm among Freud's followers. Statistical research conducted by Brunn showed that only 6% of Freudians accepted these late ideas of Freud. This version of psychoanalysis has never been fully incorporated into mainstream psychoanalytic thinking. Even Freud's ardent followers were strong in their criticism of the late Freud. He was a brilliant observer as long as he talked about sex. When he started writing about death, his ideas were distorted by his personal problems. He lost too many relatives. He was distressed by the large number of people killed in World War I. And he suffered enormously because of a poorly fitted prosthetic device that he wore for 16 years after a mutilating resection of his jaw for an osteoclastoma. At the end of his life, he developed cancer of the tongue and ended his suffering by asking his physician for euthanasia through an overdose of morphine. Freud's early topographical model of the psyche, outlined at the beginning of the 20th century in his The Interpretation of Dreams, was derived from his analysis of dreams, the dynamics of psychoneurotic symptoms, and the psychopathology of everyday life. It distinguishes three regions of the psyche that are characterized by their relationship to consciousness: the unconscious, the preconscious, and the conscious. The unconscious contains mental representations of instinctual drives that had once been conscious, but were unacceptable and therefore banned from consciousness and repressed. All of the activity of the unconscious is to pursue the pleasure principle, to seek discharge and wish fulfillment. For this purpose, it uses primary process thinking that disregards logical connections. It has no conception of time, knows no negatives, and readily permits contradictions to coexist. It attempts to reach its goals by means of such mechanisms as condensation, displacement, and symbolization. Eventually, Freud replaced the concept of system conscious and system unconscious with his famous model of the mental apparatus, which postulated the dynamic interplay of three separate structural components of the psyche: id, ego, and superego. The id represents a primordial reservoir of instinctual energies that are ego alien and governed by the primary process. The ego is related to consciousness and governs the perception of external reality and reactions to it. The superego is the youngest of the structural components of the mind. It comes fully into being with the resolution of the Oedipus complex. One of its aspects represents the introjected prohibitions and injunctions of the parents, backed by the castration complex. This is the conscience, or the inner demon. The other aspect is what Freud called the ego ideal, which reflects the positive identification with the parents or their substitutes. In addition, Freud noticed that a certain aspect of the superego is savage and cruel, betraying its unmistakable origins in the id. He deemed it responsible for the extreme self-punishing and self-destructive tendencies observed in certain psychiatric patients. More recent contributions to Freudian theory have emphasized the role of the drives and object attachments formed in the pre-Oedipal period in the development of the superego. These pregenital precursors of the superego reflect projections of the child's own sadistic drives and a primitive concept of justice based on retaliation. These features of the child's psyche were confirmed by Melanie Klein using sand play as a therapeutic tool. However, research suggests that the violent impulses Klein observed in children's play might also have perinatal origins, as we shall see. In general, the practice of psychoanalytic therapy reflects the Cartesian dichotomy between mind and body. This is expressed in psychoanalytic practice through its exclusive focus on mental processes. It involves no direct physical interventions. There is actually a strong taboo against any physical contact with the patient. Some psychoanalysts have even strongly advised against shaking hands with the patients, as it could be potentially dangerous for the transference-countertransference dynamics. Intense emotional expression and physical activity was referred to as acting out and seen as an impediment in the therapeutic process. This outline of the basic concepts of classical psychoanalysis and its theoretical and practical vicissitudes provides a basis for considering Freud's contributions in light of the observations from deep experiential psychotherapy involving holotropic states of consciousness. In general, it is possible to say that psychoanalysis appears to be an adequate conceptual framework, as long as the sessions focus on the biographical level of the unconscious. The psychosexual dynamics and the fundamental conflicts of the human psyche, as described by Freud, manifest with unusual clarity and vividness, even in sessions with naive subjects who have never been analyzed, have not read psychoanalytic books, and have not been exposed to any other forms of explicit or implicit indoctrination. They experience regression to childhood and even early infancy, relive various psychosexual traumas and complex sensations related to infantile sexuality, and are confronted with conflicts involving activities in various libidinal zones. They have to face and work through the basic psychological problems described by psychoanalysis, such as the Oedipus or Electra complex, the trauma of weaning, castration anxiety, penis envy, and conflicts around toilet training. The work with holotropic states also confirms Freud's observations concerning the biographical roots of psychoneuroses and psychosomatic disorders and their specific connections with various erogenous zones and stages of ego development. However, two major revisions must be introduced into the Freudian conceptual framework to account for certain important aspects of the biographical level of the unconscious. The first of these is the concept of dynamic governing systems, organizing emotionally relevant memories, for which I have coined the term COEX systems. The second revision involves the paramount psychotraumatic impact of physical traumas, such as operations, diseases, injuries, or near drowning, which Freudian psychoanalysis did not recognize and take into consideration. Such memories play an important role in the genesis of various emotional and psychosomatic symptoms and provide an experiential bridge to corresponding elements of the perinatal level. We discussed these differences in an earlier chapter. However, these are minor problems that could easily be corrected. The fundamental fallacy of psychoanalysis is its exclusive emphasis on postnatal biographical events and on the individual unconscious. It tries to generalize its findings, which are certainly relevant for one's superficial and narrow band of consciousness, to other levels of consciousness, and to the totality of the human psyche. Thus, its major shortcoming is that it has no genuine recognition of the perinatal and transpersonal levels of the unconscious. This makes psychoanalysis essentially useless as a conceptual framework for working with holotropic states of consciousness, such as psychedelic therapy, holotropic breathwork, and supporting individuals undergoing a spiritual emergency. Navigating these states requires knowledge of the perinatal and transpersonal domains of the psyche. Being limited to postnatal biography, psychoanalysis provides a superficial and inadequate understanding of psychopathology. According to Freud, the etiology and dynamics of emotional disorders is almost entirely explainable from postnatal events. As we have discussed earlier, experiential therapies bring overwhelming evidence that childhood traumas do not represent the primary pathogenic causes for emotional and psychosomatic disorders. They represent superficial layers superimposed over emotions, physical energies, and contents from deeper levels of the psyche. Symptoms of emotional and psychosomatic disorders have an intricate multi-level and multidimensional dynamic structure, COEX systems. The biographical layers represent only one component of this complex network. Important roots of the problems involved can almost always be found on the perinatal and transpersonal levels. The incorporation of the perinatal level into the cartography of the unconscious has far-reaching consequences for psychoanalytic theory. It clarifies many of its problems and puts them in a very different perspective. The shift of emphasis from biographically determined sexual dynamics to the dynamics of the basic perinatal matrices, BPMs, is possible without rejecting most of the important findings of psychoanalysis because of the deep experiential similarity between the pattern of sexual orgasm and the orgasm of biological birth, and the simultaneous activation and engagement of all the erogenous zones, oral, anal, urethral, and phallic, during childbirth. The awareness of perinatal dynamics and their incorporation into the cartography of the unconscious provides a simple, elegant, and powerful explanatory model for many phenomena that represented a crux for the theoretical speculations of Freud and his followers. In the realm of psychopathology, psychoanalysis has failed to provide satisfactory explanations for the phenomena of sadomasochism, automutilation, sadistic murder, and suicide. It did not adequately tackle the puzzle of the savage part of the superego, which seems to be a derivative of the id. The concept of feminine sexuality and femininity in general, as outlined by Freud, represents without doubt the weakest aspect of psychoanalysis, and borders on the bizarre and ridiculous. It lacks any genuine understanding of the female psyche. It leaves out such critical elements of women's lives as pregnancy and birth, and treats women essentially as castrated males. Psychoanalysis also offers only superficial and unconvincing interpretations for an entire spectrum of other phenomena occurring in psychiatric patients. Freud was unable to recognize the importance of perinatal dynamics and misinterpreted transpersonal experiences by reducing them to basic biological facts. For this reason, he failed to provide a reasonable basis for understanding a number of phenomena from the ritual and spiritual life of humanity, such as shamanism, totemism, rites of passage, ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, the great religions of the world, and their mystical traditions. Freud's definition of religion as the obsessive-compulsive neurosis of humanity and the obsessive-compulsive neurosis as a private religion completely missed the point by reducing the problem of religion to ritual. The sources of all religions are the transpersonal experiences of the founders, prophets, and early followers. Rituals would be empty and meaningless without their connection with visionary experiences. Equally problematic was Freud's attempt to explain religion as a result of the guilt of young males who ganged up on their father, a dominant tyrannical male in the primordial horde, murdered him, and ate him. Freud's misunderstanding of spirituality and religion is one of the main reasons why psychoanalysis is of little value for psychonautics, where the spiritual quest plays a central role. Freud's attempts to use psychoanalysis to explain sociopolitical events also fell short of providing believable insights into such phenomena as war, genocide, and bloody revolutions. As we will hear in a later section of this book, none of these can be adequately understood without taking into consideration the perinatal and transpersonal levels of the psyche. The general lack of efficacy of psychoanalysis as a therapeutic tool should also be mentioned as one of the serious shortcomings of this otherwise intriguing system of thought. However, on a number of occasions, Freud's genius came quite close to the discovery of the perinatal level of the unconscious. Many of his formulations dealt, although not explicitly, with problems closely related to birth and to the death-rebirth process. He was the first one to come up with the idea that the vital anxiety experienced during the passage through the birth canal might represent the deepest source and prototype of all future anxieties. But for some reason, he did not pursue this exciting idea any further and did not make an attempt to incorporate it into psychoanalysis. Later, he opposed the speculations of his disciple, Otto Rank, who published a drastic revision of psychoanalysis, emphasizing the paramount significance of the trauma of birth as the fundamental event of human life. In the writings of Freud and his followers, a surprisingly clear line is usually drawn between the interpretation and evaluation of prenatal or perinatal and postnatal events. The material occurring in free associations or dreams that is related to birth or intrauterine existence is consistently called fantasy, in contrast to material from the postnatal time, which is usually seen as possibly reflecting memories of actual events. Otto Rank, Nandor Fodor, and Lietard Pierre-Bolte are exceptions to this, as they had a genuine appreciation and understanding of perinatal and prenatal dynamics. Freud's development regarding the psychological importance of death was fascinating. In Freud's early writings, and in mainstream classical psychoanalysis, death had no representation in the unconscious. Fear of death was interpreted alternately as fear of castration, fear of loss of control, fear of an overwhelming sexual orgasm, or as a death wish toward another person, redirected by the strict superego back toward the subject. Freud was never quite satisfied with his thesis that the unconscious, or id, does not know death, however, and he found it increasingly difficult to deny the relevance of death for psychology and psychopathology. In his late formulations, after his recognition of the existence and importance of phenomena that lay beyond the pleasure principle, Freud introduced into his theory the concept of the death instinct, or thanatos, which he saw as being at least an equipotent counterpart to eros, or libido. Freud's understanding of death did not accurately portray its role in the perinatal dynamics, however. He was far from the insight that, in the context of the death-rebirth process, birth, sex, and death form an inextricable triad, and that all of them can function as gateways to transcendence. However, Freud's recognition of the psychological significance of death was quite remarkable. Here, as in many other areas, he was clearly far ahead of his followers. The advantages of the model that includes perinatal dynamics are far-reaching. It not only offers a more adequate and comprehensive interpretation of many emotional and psychosomatic disorders and their dynamic interrelations, but it also logically links these to anatomical, physiological, and biochemical aspects of the birth process. The phenomenon of sadomasochism can be easily explained from the experience of BPM-3, with its intimate connections between sexual arousal, pain, and aggression. The mixture of sexuality, aggression, anxiety, and scatology, which is another important characteristic of the third perinatal matrix, provides a natural context for the understanding of other sexual disorders, deviations, and perversions. On this level, sexuality and anxiety are two facets of the same process, and neither of them can be derived from the other. This throws new light on Freud's frustrating attempts to explain anxiety as being caused by the repression of libidinal feelings, and in turn, describing anxiety as having a prominent role among negative emotions that cause repression. BPM-3 is also characterized by an excessive generation of aggressive and sexual impulses, with a simultaneous blockage of external motor expression of any kind due to uterine constriction, all in the context of an extremely brutal, life-threatening, and painful situation. This appears to be the natural basis for the deepest roots of the Freudian savage superego, which is cruel and primitive. Its connection to pain, masochism, self-mutilation, violence, and suicide, ego death, is easily comprehensible and constitutes no mystery if seen as an introjection of the merciless impact of the birth canal. In the context of perinatal dynamics, the concept of vagina dentata, female genitals that can kill or castrate, was considered by Freud a product of primitive infantile fantasy. But it represents a realistic assessment based on the memory of birth. In the course of delivery, countless children have been killed, almost killed, or severely damaged by this potentially dangerous organ. The connection of the vagina dentata to castration fears becomes obvious when these can be traced back to their actual source, the memory of the cutting of the umbilical cord. This clarifies the paradox of the occurrence of castration fears in both sexes, as well as the fact that in their free associations, subjects in psychoanalysis equate castration with death, separation, the loss of an important relationship, suffocation, and annihilation. The image of vagina dentata thus represents an inappropriate generalization of a perception of this organ, which is correct when applied to a specific situation, namely childbirth, rather than to everyday life. It is this generalization, not the perception itself, which is wrong. The recognition of the perinatal level of the unconscious eliminates a serious logical gap in psychoanalytic thinking that is hard to explain in view of the otherwise intellectual acuity of psychoanalysts. According to Freud, his followers, and many theoreticians inspired by him, very early events that occurred during the oral period of the infant's life can have profound influence on later psychological development. This is generally accepted, even for relatively subtle influences. Thus, Harry Stack Sullivan suggested that the nursing infant is able to distinguish experiential nuances in the oral erogenous zone, such as a good nipple, evil nipple, and wrong nipple. A good nipple provides milk, and the mother is behaving in a loving way. An evil nipple gives milk, but the mother is rejecting or anxious. The wrong nipple, such as the infant's big toe, fails to give milk. Which kind of nipple the infant experiences can then have a profound impact on his or her entire life. How then could the same organism that is a connoisseur of nipples possibly have missed experiencing a few minutes or hours earlier the extreme conditions of delivery, life-threatening anoxia, extreme mechanical pressures, agonizing pain, and a whole spectrum of other alarming signals of vital danger? According to the observations from psychedelic therapy, various biological and psychological subtleties of nursing are of great importance. However, as one could expect from the above description, the relevance of the birth trauma is of a far higher order. The infant has to be certain about an adequate supply of life-giving oxygen before he or she can feel hunger or cold, notice whether the mother is present or absent, or distinguish the nuances of the nursing experience. Birth and death are events of fundamental relevance that occupy a meta position in relation to all the other experiences of life. They are the alpha and omega of human existence. A psychological system that does not incorporate them is bound to remain superficial, incomplete, and of limited relevance. The psychoanalytic model also fails to provide any useful clues for the understanding of the ritual and spiritual life of humanity, the phenomenology of psychotic experiences, world mythology, and serious social psychopathology, such as wars and revolutions, totalitarianism, and genocide. Any serious approach to all these phenomena requires knowledge of the perinatal and transpersonal dynamics. It is thus clearly beyond the reach of classical Freudian analysis. The discussion of psychoanalysis may not satisfy its contemporary practitioners, since it is limited to classical Freudian concepts and does not take into consideration important recent developments in this field. It seems therefore appropriate to offer a brief reference to the theory and practice of ego psychology. The origins of this discipline can be found in the writings of Sigmund Freud and Anna Freud. Its basic concepts were further developed and refined by Heinz Hartmann, Ernst Kriss, Rudolf Löwenstein, René Spitz, Margaret Mahler, Edith Jacobson, Otto Kernberg, Heinz Kohut, and others. The basic theoretical modifications of classical psychoanalysis include a sophisticated development of the concept of object relations, appreciation of their central role in the development of the personality, and focus on the problems of human adaptation. Additional important concepts explored by ego psychology are the conflict-free zones in the psyche, the inborn ego apparatus, and average expectable environment. Ego psychology considerably expands the spectrum of psychoanalytic interests, including, on the one hand, normal human development, and on the other, severe psychopathologies, autistic and symbiotic infantile psychoses, narcissistic personality disorder, and borderline personality. These changes in theory have also found their reflection in the therapeutic techniques. Such technical innovations as ego building, drive attenuation, and the correction of distortion of structure make it possible to attempt psychotherapeutic work with patients who have precarious ego strength and show borderline psychotic symptomatology. As significant as these developments are for psychoanalysis, they maintain the serious limitation of classical Freudian thought's narrow biographical orientation. Since they do not recognize the perinatal and transpersonal levels of the psyche, they cannot reach a true comprehension of psychopathology. Instead, they spin out refinements of concepts related to a layer of the psyche that is not sufficient for its understanding. Many borderline and psychotic states have significant roots in the negative aspects of perinatal matrices or in the transpersonal domain. By the same token, ego psychology cannot conceive of and utilize the powerful mechanisms of healing and personality transformation that are available through experiential access to trans-individual realms of the psyche. In light of the therapeutic strategies presented in this encyclopedia, the main problem is not to protect and build up the ego through sophisticated verbal maneuvers, but to create a supportive framework within which it can be experientially transcended. The experience of ego death and the ensuing unitive experiences, both of a symbiotic, biological, and transcendental nature, then become the sources of new strength and personal identity. Understanding the concept and mechanisms of this kind and their utilization in therapy are as far beyond the reach of ego psychology as they were for classical Freudian analysis. The famous renegades, Alfred Adler. In The Dynamics of Neurosis, Alfred Adler's individual psychology puts great emphasis on feelings of inadequacy and the constitutional inferiority of some organs or systems of organs and the tendency to overcome these. Striving for superiority and success follows a strictly subjective pattern reflecting the circumstances of one's life, particularly one's biological endowment and early childhood environment. Adler's concept of inferiority is broader than it appears at first sight, though, as it includes insecurity and anxiety, among other elements. Similarly, the striving for superiority is a search for perfection and completion, but it also implies a search for meaning in life. A deeper hidden dimension behind the inferiority complex is the memory of infantile helplessness, and at its bottom is impotence in view of the dictate of death. This focus on infantile helplessness and death brings Adler's thinking close to the recognition of the importance of the trauma of birth, in which these are essential elements. The inferiority complex can lead, through the mechanism of overcompensation to superior performance and, in extreme cases, create a genius. Adler's favorite example was Demosthenes, a stammering Greek boy with a weak voice and a tick in his shoulder, who became the most powerful orator of all time. He practiced his speeches on the ocean shore with a stone under his tongue, trying to compete with the sound of the waves. A sword suspended from a tree above his shoulder hurt him every time he had a tick. In less fortunate cases, the same mechanism can create a neurosis. Alfred Adler's individual psychology remained limited to the biographical level, like Freudian psychoanalysis, but its focus differed. In contrast with Freud's deterministic emphasis, Adler's approach was clearly teleological and finalistic. Freud explored historical and causal aspects of the pathogenesis of neurosis and other mental phenomena, whereas Adler was interested in their purpose and final goal. According to him, the guiding principle of every neurosis is the imaginary aim to be a complete man. According to Adler, the sexual drives and the tendencies toward sexual perversions of various kinds, as emphasized by Freud, are only secondary expressions of this guiding principle. The preponderance of sexual material in the fantasy life of a neurotic is simply a jargon, a modus descendi, expressing strivings toward the masculine goal. This drive for superiority, totality, and perfection reflects a deep need to compensate for all pervasive feelings of inferiority and inadequacy. In his therapeutic practice, Adler emphasized the active role of the therapist. He interpreted society for the patient, analyzed his lifestyle and goals, and suggested specific modifications. He gave encouragement, instilled hope, restored the patient's faith in himself, and helped him to realize his strength and ability. In Adler's psychology, the therapist's understanding of the patient is considered to be essential for the successful reconstruction of the patient. The patient's insight into his own motivations, intentions, and goals is not seen as a prerequisite for therapeutic change. Adler saw the Freudian concept of transference as erroneous and misleading, and as an unnecessary obstacle to the therapeutic progress. He emphasized that the therapist should be warm, trustworthy, reliable, and interested in the patient's well-being in the here and now. The observations from LSD work and other experiential approaches bring an interesting new perspective and insight into the theoretical conflict between Adler and Freud. In general, this controversy is based on the erroneous belief that the complexity of the psyche can be reduced to some simple fundamental principles. The human mind is so complex that many different theories can be constructed, all of which seem to be logical, coherent, and explain major facts of observations, yet at the same time are mutually incompatible or actually contradict each other. More specifically, the disagreements between psychoanalysis and individual psychology reflect a lack of awareness of the spectrum of consciousness with its different levels. In this sense, both systems are incomplete and superficial, since they focus exclusively on the biographical level and do not acknowledge the perinatal and transpersonal realms. Consequently, projections of various elements from these neglected areas of the psyche appear in both systems in a distorted and diluted form. The conflict between the emphasis on the sexual drive and on the will toward power and masculine protest appears to be important and irreconcilable only as long as one's knowledge of the psyche is limited to the biographical level. As we have already discussed, intense sexual arousal, including activation of the oral, anal, urethral, and genital erogenous zones, and feelings of helplessness, alternating with desperate attempts to mobilize one's strength and survive, represent integral and inseparable aspects of the dynamics of BPM-3. Although in respect to the death-rebirth process, there may temporarily be more emphasis on the sexual or the power aspect of the perinatal unfolding, the two are inextricably interwoven. As an example, the study A Sexual Profile of Men in Power by Sam Janis, Barbara Bess, and Carol Saltis is based on more than 700 hours of interviews with high-class call girls from the East Coast of the United States. Unlike many other researchers, the authors were less interested in the personalities of the prostitutes than in the preferences and habits of their customers. Among these men were many prominent American politicians, presidents of large companies and law firms, and a Supreme Court judge. The interviews revealed that only an absolute minority of the clients simply sought sexual intercourse. Most of them were interested in various alternative erotic practices that would qualify as heavy, kinky sex. Requests for bondage, whipping, and other forms of torture were very common. Some of these clients were willing to pay high prices for the psychodramatic staging of complex sadomasochistic scenes. One of the clients, for example, requested a realistic enactment of a situation in which he played the role of an American pilot shot down and captured in Nazi Germany during World War II. The prostitutes were asked to dress as bestial Gestapo women wearing high boots and military helmets. Their task was to subject the client to various ingenious tortures. Among the frequently requested and highly priced practices were the golden shower and brown shower, being urinated and defecated on during the sexual act. According to the accounts of the call girls, after the sadomasochistic and scatological experience culminated and their clients reached sexual orgasm, many of these extremely ambitious and influential men regressed to an infantile state. They wanted to be held, suck on the prostitute's nipples, and be treated like babies. This behavior was in sharp contrast with the public image these men had been trying to project in their everyday life. The interpretations of these findings offered in the book are strictly biographical and Freudian in nature. The authors linked tortures to parental punishments, the golden shower and brown shower to problems related to toilet training, the need for sucking the breast to frustrated nursing and anaclytic needs, mother fixation, and the like. However, closer inspection reveals that the clients actually enacted classical perinatal scenes rather than postnatal childhood events. The combination of physical restraint, pain and torture, sexual arousal, scatological involvement, and subsequent regressive oral behavior are unmistakable indications of the activation of BPM 3 and 4. The conclusions of Janis, Bess, and Saltis deserve special notice. The authors appealed to the American public not to expect their politicians and other prominent public figures to be models of sexual behavior. In the light of their research, this expectation would be highly unrealistic. Their findings indicated that the high degree of drive and ambition that it takes to become a successful public figure in today's society is inextricably linked with an excessive sexual drive and an inclination to deviant sexuality.